Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at thomisticinstitute.org.
Good evening. Thank you all for coming out on a Thursday night. I'm grateful to the Thomistic Institute for the invitation to come speak and to the Newman Center for your hospitality. So, without further ado, in its dogmatic constitution on the Church, Lumen Gentium, the Second Vatican Council declares that, quote, the Eucharistic sacrifice is the source and summit of the whole Christian life. In recent years, this phrase has become something of a catchphrase for Catholic efforts at Eucharistic evangelization. And it's often employed as a memorable, alliterative way to say something like, the Eucharist is really important. Yet beneath this pithy slogan is a profound theological claim that too often remains unexplored. What does it mean for the Eucharist to be the source of the Christian life? And what does it mean to hold that the Eucharist is the summit of that same life? The phrase suggests not merely that the Eucharist is really important, although it is, but also that the Eucharist plays a unique role in relation to the rest of the Christian life, including and especially our pursuit of holiness in the moral life. In what follows, I wish to meditate on how the Eucharist is both the source and the summit of the Christian moral life. That is to say, how the moral life flows from the Eucharist as its origin and how it's directed back to the Eucharist as its consummation. In doing so, I'll draw upon the thought of the 13th century Dominican friar and doctor of the church, St. Thomas Aquinas, whose writings on both the Eucharist and the moral life have played a pivotal role in the development of Catholic theology over the centuries. In his most mature work, the Summa Theologiae, Thomas considers the Eucharist from two perspectives, as a sacrament and as a sacrifice. I wish to suggest, and this is my thesis, that these two categories of sacrament and sacrifice helpfully illuminate the Eucharist's twofold role as source and summit, respectively, of the Christian moral life. As sacrament, the Eucharist nourishes and strengthens Christians to advance in holiness of life. And as a sacrifice, the Eucharist becomes the occasion for their life of holiness to be offered back to God in worship. To that end, my presentation unfolds in three main parts. In the first section, I'll offer an overview of St. Thomas's account of the Christian moral life as characterized by growth in virtue. And I'll give a special attention to the crucial role that grace plays in the Christian's pursuit of holiness. The second section explores how the Eucharist, considered as a sacrament, is the source of the Christian moral life. Beginning with an overview of Aquinas' theology of the sacraments, I wish to demonstrate how the sacraments, including and especially the Eucharist, play an indispensable role as causes of grace that fuel the moral life. Finally, the third section will examine how the Eucharist, understood in terms of sacrifice, is the proper summit or culmination of the Christian's life of virtue. After a brief description of Aquinas' claim that Christians, by sharing in Jesus' priesthood, are called to direct all their virtuous actions to the worship of God, I'll show how those offerings are taken up and perfected by being united to the sacrifice of Christ made present in the Eucharist. Thus, I hope we shall come to see how, as both source and summit, sacrament and sacrifice, the Eucharist makes us holy. So, part one. For St. Thomas Aquinas, holiness refers to a certain moral and spiritual excellence, or perfection, of the human person. The emphasis on the moral life as the pursuit of excellence is borne out by Aquinas' choice to frame his moral theology principally in terms of virtue. Now, to understand Aquinas' account of virtue, what he means by it, it's first helpful to consider the broader category to which virtue belongs. Virtue, Aquinas argues, is a kind of habitus. And I'm going to leave the word untranslated because habitus is not the same thing as a habit. We'll see why. A habitus, he says, is a stable disposition that gives definition and specificity to our natural human capacities for knowing, choosing, and feeling, so that we can exercise these abilities in particular ways and with a certain consistency and even skill. Thus, we might think of certain habitus like the habitus of speaking a language or playing a musical instrument, in which we've developed a stable disposition to execute a certain activity with skill and ease. Indeed, we might even speak of such habitus as being second nature, because they incline us to kinds of activity that our human nature, left undeveloped, doesn't. But they incline us to those activities in such a way that we can perform them with a certain promptness, ease, and pleasure that feels almost natural. Now, while having the habitus of speaking English or playing tennis might make someone a good speaker or a good athlete, virtues are the kinds of habitus that make one a good human being. Full stop. Thus, Aquinas accepts, among other definitions, the Greek philosopher Aristotle's description of virtue as, quote, that which makes its possessor good and his work good also. Virtues give a stable perfection to our human capacities by accustoming them to act in ways that conform to reason, which is the standard by which human goodness is measured. For example, the virtue of courage enables a person consistently both to feel and to respond to the emotion of fear in a way that's reasonable, so that the courageous person is neither paralyzed by fear nor overcome by recklessness. Similarly, the virtue of temperance allows a person to pursue bodily pleasures, like the pleasures of eating, drinking, and sexual intimacy, in a reasonable manner, neither prudishly rejecting the good things of God's creation, nor wantonly overindulging in them. The virtues, therefore, allow one to live a life that is authentically and integrally reasonable, and therefore human, and to do so with consistency, ease, and delight. Now, Aquinas thinks that some of these virtues, a group that he calls the moral virtues, virtues like justice, temperance, courage, honesty, generosity, and more, these, he thinks, can be acquired by a process of habituation. Now, when I teach this to students in Providence, Rhode Island, I often use the example of sledding, which seems a little less appropriate in this context. But bear with me. After a fresh snowfall, the first pass down a hill on a sled is often slow, difficult, and plodding. The snow isn't packed down. There are no tracks in the snow for the grooves of the sled to fit into. There are probably leaves, branches, and other obstacles that hinder your run down the hill. But once you've taken your sled down the same path a few times, the snow becomes more compact. The grooves from your sled have formed a path in the snow, and you can sail down the hill smoothly and effortlessly. The same holds true in the moral life. The initial steps at cultivating, say, the virtue of honesty may be difficult, especially if you have an already established vice of dishonesty that you must first overcome. But the more you tell the truth consistently and wisely, the easier and more second nature truth-telling will become for you. The moral virtues that you acquire and cultivate through repeated action perfect the human person on the level of human nature, making one the kind of person who's truly and authentically human, capable of achieving all the goods at which human nature aims. But human beings are not only created to pursue the goods at which human nature aims. We're also called to pursue an even higher good, which paradoxically exceeds the capacities of our human nature. And while the virtues that can be acquired by human effort and habituation might help to perfect us for living a flourishing life in this world, they are insufficient for attaining the heavenly happiness to which God invites us. Therefore, Aquinas contends, quote, it is necessary for man to receive from God some additional principles, whereby he may be directed to supernatural happiness. These additional principles are the theological virtues of faith, hope, and charity, about which St. Paul writes in his first letter to the Corinthians. The theological virtues differ from the moral virtues, not only because they are gifts bestowed directly by God and not acquired through human effort, but also because the theological virtues, Thomas says, have God as their object. What does that mean? The object of a virtue specifies or defines the virtue and its sphere of activity. So, for example, justice is the virtue that gives one a stable disposition to give to others what is owed to them. So the object of justice is that which is owed. That's what it's about. It's about what is due to other people. Or maybe even more clearly, the virtue of temperance is the virtue that moderates our desire for bodily pleasures. So bodily pleasure is the object of temperance. That's what it's about. But for the theological virtues of faith, hope, and charity, their object is God himself. Faith, hope, and charity are about God. Faith is the virtue by which we believe God and what God reveals about himself. Hope is the virtue by which we confidently long for God as the source of our ultimate happiness. And then there's charity. Faith, hope, and charity abide these three, writes St. Paul. And the greatest of these is charity, love. Charity is the theological virtue by which we love God above all things and love God for God's own sake, rather than for the sake of whatever benefits we receive from God. In addition, Aquinas holds that charity also entails the love of our neighbor, including love of our enemies, as a necessary extension of our love for God. For Thomas, as for St. Paul, charity is the greatest of all the virtues. In fact, when he reflects on what constitutes the moral and spiritual perfection of the human person, Thomas says quite plainly, quote, "The perfection of the Christian life consists radically in charity." Indeed, he maintains that charity is the essential form of the whole Christian life, and charity puts its stamp on all the other virtues, transforming them into expressions of love for God. Despite Aquinas' emphasis on charity as the most excellent virtue, when he first considers charity in the Summa Theologiae, he doesn't define it in terms of virtue. Instead, Aquinas proposes, rather curiously, that charity is, quote, "a kind of friendship between human beings and God." Now, this is among Thomas's most revolutionary theological claims, and it has important implications for the relationship between God and human beings. When Thomas talks about love earlier in the Summa, he elaborates a rich and beautiful account of friendship, considered simply at the level of friendship between human beings. The love of friendship, he says, establishes a deep and abiding union between friends, such that a friend can rightly be called another self. In fact, Thomas uses the almost mystical-sounding language of mutual indwelling to describe friendship, that friends dwell in one another, writing that in the love of friendship, quote, "the lover is in the beloved, inasmuch as he reckons what is good or evil to his friend as being good or evil for himself, and takes his friend's will as his own, so that it seems as though he felt the good or suffered the evil in the very person of his friend." So Thomas says that for our friends, right, their good becomes our good. We rejoice when they rejoice. We suffer when our friends suffer. Mutual indwelling. So for Thomas to speak of charity as friendship with God is to suggest that charity involves a deep and abiding intimacy between God and human beings. Now, this all sounds very nice, I suppose, but we have to ask a kind of obvious and yet rather difficult question. Can human beings really be friends with God? Indeed, according to Aristotle, the ancient Greek philosopher whose reflections on friendship are so influential for Aquinas, Aristotle says that a certain equality is a necessary precondition for friendship. It's not possible, Aristotle argued, for parents to be friends with their children, for superiors to be friends with their subordinates, or for the gods to be friends with human beings. There's too great a dissimilarity, Aristotle says, for people of such disparate status to genuinely share a common life together. And a common life, Aristotle thinks, is an essential ingredient of friendship. It belongs to friends that they dwell together, they share life together. Now, Aquinas takes this concern seriously, and he doesn't dispute that there exists a profound unlikeness between human beings and God in two very important ways. The first way, right, is what we might call a metaphysical dissimilarity, written into the very fabric of creation, God infinitely transcends everything else that exists. God infinitely transcends his creation and is therefore radically different from creatures, including human beings. Thus, Thomas says that human beings, even before sin, even before the fall, remained at an infinite distance from God. Even before the fall, human beings on their own could not be friends with God. The second aspect of human beings' unlikeness to God compounds the problem. And this is the moral distance between human beings and God that's introduced by sin. The original sin that we all inherit alienates us, estranges us from God. And this estrangement introduces a further disorder into our human nature. While human beings, before the fall, although they were incapable of friendship with God, they could at least function properly, pursuing a flourishing life in this world. But original sin so distorts human nature that even the flourishing to which we're naturally proportioned now becomes impossible for us. Because of original sin, we are born with wills that are weakened, minds that are darkened, and emotions that are chaotic and disordered. Left to our own devices, we lack any real capacity to desire or accomplish what is good for us, even at the level of this worldly flourishing. Thus, Thomas argues, if human beings were unequal to God, and therefore incapable of friendship with him, even before sin, how much more are we now, wounded by sin, so far removed from God, as to render the idea of friendship with him altogether unthinkable? For Aquinas, the ontological and moral gap that marks our present condition is completely unbridgeable on the part of human beings. There's nothing, he thinks, that we can do to heal ourselves from the wounds of sin, or to overcome the ontological distance between our finite human nature and the infinite God. Instead, this ontological and moral distance must be overcome from God's side. Human beings, in other words, can only become friends of God because God wills to befriend them. We can only love God in charity because God has loved us first. This is why when Aquinas comments on St. Paul's claim in the letter to the Romans that the love of God to our hearts takes a twofold meaning. The love of God has been poured into our hearts. Love of God both can mean God's love for us, or also the love of God can mean our love for God. Thomas thinks both of these are poured into our hearts. God, by loving us, makes us capable of loving him in return. This observation brings into focus an important point about the nature of God's love and how God's love differs from human love. Aquinas explains, here's a longer quote, God loves all things that exist, yet not in the same way that we love. Because our will is not the cause of goodness, of the goodness of things, but is moved by the goodness of things as by its object. Our love, whereby we wish the good for anything, is not the cause of its goodness, but rather its goodness calls forth our love, whereas the love of God infuses and creates goodness. What's he saying? Human love is primarily a response to the goodness that's already present in the things that we love. I love my wife because I can see the goodness in her. My love doesn't make my wife good. I love my wife because she's already good. God's love, however, is not responsive to the goodness of his creatures. Rather, God's love is the cause of their goodness. God doesn't love us because we are already good. Rather, Aquinas thinks, God's love makes us good. In other words, unlike human love, God's love is causal and transformative. It brings about a real effect, a real change in God's beloved. For St. Thomas, and for the Catholic tradition more broadly, the name for this effect of God's love in the human person is grace. When God loves human beings and wills some good for them, God's love accomplishes a transformative effect in the human person, which is grace. We can be more specific about this transformative effect of grace. Thomas has a penchant for making distinctions. I could go on for an hour about all the distinctions that he makes about grace. But I want to focus simply on one kind of grace that's most relevant to our discussion. Aquinas calls this in Latin, gratia gratum faciens, which literally translated means the grace that makes pleasing. Or maybe to render it a little bit better, sanctifying grace, the grace which makes one holy. Sanctifying grace makes one holy. It accomplishes this effect in two ways that overcome the two kinds of distance between God and human beings that prevent us from being friends. First, sanctifying grace overcomes the moral distance between God and human beings because grace heals the soul by accomplishing the forgiveness of sin. Second, sanctifying grace overcomes the ontological distance between God and human beings by elevating the human person to a new mode of existence. For Aquinas, grace does not merely note a change in the way that God perceives or regards us, nor is it a fancy theological way for saying that we can kind of feel better about ourselves. Rather, Aquinas emphatically affirms that sanctifying grace brings about a real and radical transformation of human beings, divinizing us, making us, as scripture puts it, partakers of the divine nature. It makes us godlike. Thomas classifies sanctifying grace as a habitus, one of those stable dispositions, which divinizes, makes divine the human person in the very essence of her soul, at the core of her being. But Thomas also says that the effects of grace extend to all the powers, all the capacities of the soul through virtues and gifts of the Holy Spirit that flow from grace. In this way, grace's transformative effects reach not just the core of the human person, but all of our capacities for knowing, choosing, and desiring are taken up, healed, elevated, transformed, and perfected, making us like God. This likeness brought about by grace now makes possible the shared life, the kind of equality that Aristotle says is necessary for friendship. Charity, in other words, flows from and is only made possible by God's prior action of healing and elevating us by grace. Now, how does this grace reach us? How is this transformative effect of God's love given to us? Now, as one might expect, Aquinas says that God is the sole author of grace. After all, you can't give what you don't have, and if grace is a sharing in God's own nature, who but God himself could give such a gift? Nevertheless, Aquinas also argues that grace typically doesn't proceed directly from God to human beings, but rather reaches human beings through the mediation, middleman, of created things. Thomas says that it's a feature of God's wisdom, his providence, and his care for us, that he works through creative things. Thomas says that God does this, quote, not on account of any defect in God's power, but by reason of the abundance of God's goodness, so that the dignity of being a cause is imparted to creatures. God could, and perhaps sometimes even does, give grace to human beings directly and without mediation,
divinely zapping human beings with grace.
But Aquinas argues that it's not merely possible, but fitting, appropriate, that God should make use of created things, including, as we'll see, the sacraments, to draw human beings to himself. Thomas says this is not the result of weakness on God's part, but is rather an illustration of God's greatness, as God permits his creation to have the dignity and sharing in God's own power to sanctify. Aquinas clarifies this relationship between God and these created intermediaries of grace by making a distinction between what he calls primary causality and instrumental causality. Side note, instrumental causality is a great name for a band. Okay? Understand this distinction. Consider the act of my writing on a chalk. Have one in here, but imagine that we had a chalkboard that I wrote on. What would you say is the cause of the writing that appears on the chalkboard? On the one hand, it might seem like I'm the cause of the writing. since without me pressing the chalk against the board and moving my arm, there would be no writing on the board. But on the other hand, you might be tempted to say that the chalk is the cause of the writing, since my arm movements in front of the board without a piece of chalk would not result in any writing on the board. No effect. In reality, both the chalk and I are causes of the writing, but in different ways. I, as the primary cause, am the ultimate source of the writing on the board. But I make use of the chalk as an instrumental cause in bringing about my effect. Both the chalk and I are genuine causes of the writing that appears on the board. But there's a sort of priority that obtains between us. The writing finds its origin in me as the principal cause and passes through the instrumental mediation of the chalk. In the same way, Aquinas thinks that while God is the primary source of grace, like the one writing on the chalkboard, God makes use of instrumental causes to communicate grace to human beings. Chief among these instrumental causes is the human nature of Jesus. In the incarnation, the divine person of the Son, the second person of the Trinity, takes on our human flesh and assumes our human nature, so that Christians rightly confess Jesus to be true God and true man. Aquinas maintains that this divine person of the Son acts through his human nature as an instrument, so that, quote, all the things that Christ does and suffers in his humanity operate as instruments for the salvation of human beings. Thomas argues that this is especially true of Jesus' suffering and death, right, in which the suffering he experiences in his humanity serves as the instrument of his divine nature in order to merit salvation not only for himself, but for all who are joined to him. In short, Aquinas insists that every grace we receive is merited by and flows from the humanity of Christ. At the same time, he suggests that although Christ's passion merits grace for human beings in a kind of universal and abstract way, nevertheless, the effects of Christ's passion need to be applied to each individual. Each of us needs to make contact, as it were, with the grace that flows from Christ's suffering and death and resurrection. And as a result, further instrumental causes of grace are necessary. Those further instrumental causes, which themselves draw strength from Christ's passion, are the sacraments. Aquinas defines the sacrament as, quote, the sign of a holy thing, insofar as it makes men holy. As signs, the sacraments are physical, material things, words and actions that make use of water and oil, bread and wine, but they point to a spiritual reality. As we noted earlier, Thomas thinks it's fitting for God to make use of created things to share his grace with human beings. God, in his wisdom, wishes for his grace to reach us in a way that's appropriate to our nature. And a key aspect of our nature as human beings is our embodiment. We're physical beings. In light of this, Thomas argues that human nature has to be led by corporeal things to spiritual things. He writes, "The divine wisdom, therefore, fittingly provides man with means of salvation in the shape of bodily and visible signs called sacraments." In this way, Thomas sees that the healing and elevating work of grace engages human beings in a way that's suited to us as embodied creatures who engage reality primarily through our senses. And meeting us at our level, as it were, the sacraments lift us up through the material world to the things of God. Yet Thomas insists that the sacraments are not merely signs in the sense that they point to a spiritual reality distinct from themselves. There's a sign outside this building that says St. Thomas More Catholic Newman Center. But that sign is not the St. Thomas More Catholic Newman Center. It's a sign that points to a further reality, this building. The sacraments, in the same way, are not merely indicators of grace or rituals that symbolize some separate bestowal of grace. Rather, Thomas says that the sacraments are efficacious signs. They effect or bring about what they signify. Rather than merely signifying or pointing to a spiritual reality out there, The sacraments, in their very signifying, bring about the reality they point to. Or as one renowned theologian has so profoundly stated it, sacraments do something. It's hard for us to think of examples of this, but there are a few, right? A sacrament that affects what, or a sign that brings about what it signifies. Think about signing a contract, right? Your signature on that contract is a sign, right? That you have agreed to this set of terms and conditions, that you've entered into this arrangement. So your signature on the contract is a sign, right, of the enforceable nature of this contract. But your signature on the contract also brings about the contract. Left unsigned, there's no agreement to be enforced. The signature on the contract both signifies and accomplishes the contract. Or think of a baseball umpire. Baseball umpires have all sorts of, right, signs and gestures that they make to indicate that someone is safe or out, that it's a ball or a strike. I can make those same gestures sitting in my seat in the grandstands, right? But my signs don't have an effect. I can do this all day long and the runner will still be out, right? But the umpire's sign, right, brings about the thing that it signifies. When the umpire says out, the runner's out. Right? Even if, like, we go back later and watch the replay and, right, his foot hit the bag nanoseconds before the ball hit the glove. Right? The umpire's sign is an efficacious one. It brings about what it signifies. So too the sacraments. The sacraments not only signify a spiritual reality, they also bring it about. They don't just point to grace, they also cause it. The sacraments are instrumental causes, to be sure, but they're true causes of grace nonetheless. The idea that the sacraments are instrumental causes of grace also helps us to make sense of the fact that the church celebrates seven different sacraments. Going back to the example of the chalkboard, consider the difference between my writing on the chalkboard with a piece of chalk and my writing on the blackboard with a paintbrush. Although in both cases I'm the primary cause of the writing, the instrument that I employ brings its own proper identity to the task and leaves its own distinctive mark on the effect. Different tools, different results. So too, Thomas says, does God's grace come to work in us through the various sacraments as through various instruments. Each of the seven sacraments, drawing on its own distinctive value as a sign of a holy thing, communicates its own unique mode of grace, which aims to heal, elevate, and sanctify us in a specific way. What then is the Eucharist's unique mode of sanctifying human beings? When Thomas argues that it's fitting that there should be seven sacraments, he suggests that what we need to flourish in the supernatural life of grace is similar to what we need to flourish on a natural level. He thinks there's an analogy there. Thus, the seven sacraments mark out distinctive moments of transition, growth, and healing in the life of grace. For example, baptism accomplishes a spiritual generation that's analogous to physical birth. Or penance causes a spiritual restoration similar to physical healing. Now, with respect to the Eucharist, Thomas writes, quote, "The effect of this sacrament is considered from the way in which the sacrament is given. For it is given by way of food and drink. And therefore, the Eucharist does for the spiritual life all that material food does for bodily life, namely by sustaining, increasing, restoring, and giving delight." End quote. As spiritual food, the Eucharist provides spiritual nourishment. And Thomas insists that we appropriate this effect by eating and drinking the sacred species. He argues that physically consuming this sacrament is vital for receiving spiritual nourishment, because the Eucharist, quote, contains Christ himself. Thomas insists that Christ is really and truly present in the Eucharist under the outward appearances of bread and wine, a teaching he elaborates under the fancy theological name of transubstantiation. Thus, he says, in receiving spiritual nourishment from the Eucharist, we are truly being nourished by Christ's own body and blood. Thomas takes this claim seriously, writing that the Eucharist, quote, was instituted for nourishing us spiritually through union between Christ and his members, just as nourishment is united with the person who is nourished. End quote. Just like the physical act of eating unites the eater with the food on a biological level, so too does the reception of the Eucharist bring about an intimate spiritual union between Christ, who is contained in the food, and the Christian who eats it. Thomas speaks of this union specifically in terms of friendship, noting that Christ's true presence in the Eucharist, quote, belongs to Christ's love, out of which for our salvation, he assumed a true body of our nature. And because it's a special feature of friendship to live together with friends, as Aristotle says, he promises us his bodily presence as a reward, saying in the Gospel of Matthew, where the body is, there shall the eagles be gathered together. Yet meanwhile, in our pilgrimage of this life, he does not deprive us of his bodily presence, but unites us with himself in this sacrament through the truth of his body and blood. End quote. The friendship between Christ and the human person, however, is nothing other than the virtue of charity, which we saw earlier. Thomas therefore calls the Eucharist Sacramentum Caritatis, the sacrament of charity, and declares that the Eucharist is the sign of supreme charity out of the familiar union it establishes between Christ and us. But the union between Christ and us that the Eucharist brings about differs crucially from the union between food and eater in ordinary eating. Unlike bodily food, which when eaten is gradually broken down and assimilated by the one who eats it, the quesadilla I had for dinner is now currently becoming part of me, right? The spiritual food of the Eucharist does precisely the opposite. Thomas writes that the Eucharist accomplishes, quote, the conversion of the eater into the food. In the Eucharist, we don't assimilate the food. Food assimilates us. That is to say, the Eucharist deepens the union between us and Christ by deepening our likeness to him. Specifically, Thomas says, by increasing and stirring up our charity. By receiving Christ in the Eucharist, we are united to him more deeply, and as a result, we are strengthened to love God and our neighbor with greater zeal. And as charity is the form of the whole Christian moral life, the Eucharist strengthens and increases our capacity for virtue altogether. In this way, the Eucharist is indeed the source of the moral life. Now, recall that for Thomas, the Eucharist is not only a sacrament, but also a sacrifice. It's a sacrifice, he thinks, because it makes present, in an invisible and unbloody manner, the passion and death of Christ on the cross. In the Eucharist, the death of Christ is represented to us. And when Thomas reflects on Jesus' passion, he considers it principally in terms of sacrifice, which is an act of worship, or to use Thomas's vocabulary, an act of the virtue of religion, which is the virtue by which we render what is due, namely honor and worship to God. Sacrifice involves an external action of giving over some element of the created order to God as a visible sign of our own interior self-offering. What matters in the sacrifice is that, right, the grain or the animal or the Lenten chocolate that's offered up, right, that's not the value of the sacrifice. The sacrifice is that that thing is a sign, a visible, tangible sign of my own sacrifice, of my intellect and my will. This interior offering, Aquinas argues, is the chief element of sacrifice. But this invisible gift of self is visibly and symbolically enacted through the tangible rituals of sacrifice, because we're embodied creatures and we need that. The devotion, though, that spurs one to make such a self-offering, Thomas says, is caused and animated by charity. Inasmuch as love, Thomas says, makes one ready to serve one's friend, namely God, with whom we are made friends by charity. Thus, Thomas argues that Christ's charity, which he possessed to the greatest degree possible, imbued his passion and death with a sacrificial character. On the cross, Christ is both the priest and the victim, who offers himself to God as a perfect sacrifice, because he offers himself to God out of love. For Thomas, what's valuable about Jesus' suffering and death is not its gruesomeness primarily, but its voluntariness. What makes Christ's death an acceptable sacrifice to God is not the bloodiness, not the torture, not the abandonment by his friends, but the fact that Christ endures all these things willingly and freely out of love. Love lies at the heart of sacrifice. And it's this perfect self-offering of Christ to the Father out of love, which is commemorated and enacted every time the Eucharist is celebrated. While the Eucharist is indeed the sacramental presentation of Christ's sacrifice, the Eucharist is also the sacrifice of the church. That is to say, it's also the sacrifice of the members of Christ's body, of all the baptized. In baptism, we not only receive the grace of spiritual rebirth, but there's also a secondary effect, which Thomas calls a character or a seal, by which the baptized are consecrated and set apart for the worship of God. Thomas explains that the character, the seal we receive in baptism, is specifically, he says, quote, the character of Christ, to whose priesthood the baptized are likened. As sharers in Christ's own priesthood, all the baptized faithful, not just ordained ministerial priests, are empowered to worship God in spirit and in truth. Aquinas argues that sacrifice is a key element of the worship that Christians are called to carry out. But rather than the liturgical offerings of grains or animals that characterize Israel's worship, we are called, as St. Paul exhorts, to, quote, present your bodies as a living sacrifice, holy and acceptable to God, your spiritual worship. Commenting on this passage from the letter to the Romans, Aquinas says that a person can present his body to God as a sacrifice in three ways. Typical Aquinas. It'll list three different reasons. First, when he exposes his body to suffering and death for God's sake, I offer my body as a living sacrifice. Second, when I chastise my body by fasting and vigil in the service of God. And third, when he uses his body to perform acts of justice and divine worship. Attentive readers of Aquinas will recognize that these three ways of offering one's body to God correspond to the exercise of three of Thomas's favorite virtues: courage, temperance, and justice. The inference we can draw from this is that Thomas thinks that our spiritual worship of God, our living sacrifice, consists precisely in our practice of the virtues. When the virtuous life is lived out of devotion to God, which is itself an effect of charity, then our virtuous deeds, and indeed we ourselves, become a living sacrifice offered to God in praise. This sacrifice of the moral life is perfected, however, when it's taken up with and joined to the perfect sacrifice of Christ celebrated in the Eucharist. For this reason, the Second Vatican Council affirms that the whole moral life reaches its apex in the Eucharist. Here's a long quote from Vatican II. All their works, prayers, and apostolic endeavors, their ordinary married and family life, their daily occupations, their physical and mental relaxation, if carried out in the Spirit, and even the hardships of life, if patiently borne, all these become spiritual sacrifices acceptable to God through Christ. Together with the offering of the Lord's body, these things are most fittingly offered in the celebration of the Eucharist. End quote. This passage clearly highlights the Eucharist's place as the summit of the Christian life. Our ongoing struggle to root out vice and grow in virtue, which is manifested concretely in the good deeds we perform, become a kind of preparation for the Eucharist, insofar as they shape our very selves into a fitting sacrifice to be offered to God together with Christ's sacrifice on the altar. The practice of the virtues, in other words, facilitates our fruitful and active participation in the Eucharist, which is the summit of the Christian life. What emerges from these reflections on the Eucharist and the moral life is a dynamic rhythm that characterizes our life in Christ. The liturgical theologian David Fagerberg highlights this dynamism when he describes the narthex, the vestibule of the church building, as a membrane between what he calls the celebrated liturgy offered in the sanctuary and the lived liturgy enacted in the profane sphere of ordinary life. Fagerberg writes that the Christian crosses this membrane of the church narthex, quote, in a dialectical rhythm on a regular basis. We cross it when we go to assist at the sacrifice of the Mass, bringing along with us what we have gathered throughout the day or the week in order to place everything at the foot of the altar. And we cross it again when we obey the presider's command, ite missa est, go, the Mass is ended, bringing along with us the graces we have received in the sacrament in order to place ourselves at the service of charity in the world. End quote. We are continuously drawing strength from the Eucharist as the fount of grace and charity, and returning to the Eucharist as the occasion of joining the worship we offer through our virtues to Christ's self-offering to the Father. This cyclical rhythm of sacrament and sacrifice truly situates the Eucharist as both source and summit of the Christian life.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.